This podcast on Sports360AZ.com is brought to you by your Valley Hyundai dealers. We appreciate the Valley Hyundai dealers and their support.
Now, the Brad Sesmatt Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network studios.
Great Wednesday. Thanks for being with us. The Suns and their downtown arena blowing up. Jude LaCava has been on the story, and we'll visit with Jude from Fox 10, of course. That'll come up in about 20 minutes, in 15 minutes, actually. And there's plenty to get to on other things going on around the Arizona sports scene with Jude. Michael Fabiano, the Fantasy Football Forum. He is at the NFL Network studios in Los Angeles. Michael joins us every week. And I have Cam Newton. I have Ty Montgomery. I am host. I have Ezekiel Elliott. I'm host. And you have lots of questions that you've sent in. We will take those questions and run some things by Michael Fabiano. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it is Talk to the Lopes. Every week we talk Grand Canyon University on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Of course, their basketball program is off to a great start, but we talk about other sports as well at GCU. Matt Worley will be with us, the men's head volleyball coach. They are playing Pepperdine, UCLA, USC, Hawaii, men's volleyball. My son played it in the past. I played some, but I was a big stiff and couldn't jump. I think it's great that we have a men's volleyball program playing at the highest level here in the Valley, and we'll talk with Matt Worley on that front. And then Jordan and Haley at 11:15, while the Friday night 360 AZ show, the preview football show. We are in the semifinals across the state, and there's plenty to get to. They're going to have coaches and analysis and insight all around the high school football scene. That comes up at 11:15. So busy show ahead. Last night, so I was wrong about Torrey Lovello. Yesterday on the show, I said, you know, I think that it's going to be Dave Roberts because the national media in LA, and he did a great job. And I thought Torrey would get hosed, and I was wrong. I was dead flat wrong. Happens all the time. 18 first place votes for Torrey Lovello. Had a great season. So congratulations to the Diamondbacks manager being named manager of the year. Eric, were you surprised by this bit of news yesterday?
Pretty stunned. Pretty surprised.
Yeah? Is your camera on?
Yeah.
I don't see you. There you are.
Hi.
There you are. You're stunned and surprised, huh?
Yeah, I was. And the Dodgers did beat the Diamondbacks, but they did not win the World Series, and their manager did not win manager of the year. So.
How about that? You know, and I had some of these whiny Dodger fans that were texting me last night saying, what is up with Torrey Lovello winning manager of the year?
But when you really think about it, I mean, the turnaround is incredible.
Yes.
Like, the Dodgers were just loaded with talent. No one expected the Diamondbacks to have the type of season they did. So good for the D-backs and definitely good for Lovello. He definitely stabilized things inside that dugout that needed to be stabilized for quite a few years.
Right. Well, Scott Boros is making news over at the winter meetings by what he's saying. These are the general manager meetings. General manager's meetings are going on in Palm Springs right now. And J.D. Martinez, according to Bob Nightingale, who I trust implicitly, and a couple of other agents that said they've heard the same thing, but Bob has been out there in front of it on Twitter, that now Scott Boros is asking for $210 million for J.D. Martinez over 7 years. $210 million. That is $30 million a year. Far be it from any other agent to get more than $30 million a year. But $30 million a year for J.D. Martinez and tying him up for seven seasons. Seven long seasons. The hard part about baseball nowadays is you commit to these contracts to guys for five, six, 7 years. And I don't know, they're fine for two, three, 4 years. And then you're sitting there saying, how can we get out from under this? And it's just, we'll pay it off and we'll move them on. If you're sitting there today in the Diamondbacks front office, and you're thinking 7 years, $210 million. Are we really going to commit this knowing that Paul Goldschmidt is going to ask for more than that? Because you know Goldschmidt's agent's going to ask for more than that. Goldschmidt's a better player than J.D. Martinez, in my humble opinion. They play different positions. Eric, would we agree on this one or disagree on this one? If you had to just say, who is the better player? Martinez hits the ball a ton for one half of a season, but Goldschmidt over at first base is gold. J.D. Martinez is not the best defensive outfielder.
Yeah, I don't think there's much of an argument here.
Okay, so And I'm not looking to argue. It's just, am I off base here thinking that Goldschmidt's people are going to say, if he's $30 million, then my guy's $35
million? Because Goldschmidt has been doing it now for several years. J.D. Right. Martinez did it for – I mean, J.D. Martinez has always been a very good player, but he got hot at just the right time.
Right ballpark.
Right ballpark.
Right guy hitting in front of him, behind him, however the lineup
sure.
was set up.
A team, right? on, a team on the rise
yep.
that started getting some national love.
Contract year.
Contract year. New agent with Scott Boras.
I mean...
It is a new representative, right?
Yeah, no, okay. that's new. Yeah, he changed hands. But here's the thing on this. We're sitting here looking at the future being played out in about the next 3 to 4 weeks. Because, Eric, if they give him 30, then Goldschmidt's going to want 35. And they're not having to address Goldschmidt's contract now. This is something that's going to be... These next few weeks are going to set the tone for the next few years.
And Goldschmidt's been such a loyal soldier to this organization.
Hadn't said anything about
it. The team was bad. He just went out there and performed. Didn't say a
sure.
word. Team first guy.
What if Goldschmidt changes agents? He's already changed agents. I mean, changing agents is not a big thing, but what if he decided, I'm going to go over to Scott Boras?
And I don't know. He doesn't strike me as the big money grab type guy.
But no,
not,
Martinez
not that,
doesn't.
Not that J.D.
Yeah,
Martinez does
strike,
either.
Right, he doesn't.
It's a lot of the representatives that obviously want to make as much money for their client as they can because they make more money.
Do you know the quote we had last week from Boras about water and all that stuff, once you're in the water? So he had this one last night on Jake Arrieta. So Jake Arrieta's a free agent. And Boras represents Jake Arrieta.
Oh man, that's a really difficult situation for teams looking at Jake Arrieta.
So here's Boras's quote last night, Eric. This was good. Jake Arrieta is a squirrel with a lot of nuts in the tree. He's a big game squirrel.
He is.
So he gave that to Mark Gonzalez, our friend Gonzo at the Chicago Tribune.
He's also been a little bit beaten down and injured in the last couple seasons. And you don't see him pitching late into games like you did 2 or 3 years ago because the pitch count gets high.
Should the Diamondbacks chase him?
No.
If you move Greinke, do you have to go chase somebody like that? I say no.
I don't think so.
I say no. And do you think Archie factors in if you move Greinke? Because, you know, my stance is if they sign JD back here, they've got to move Greinke.
Yep. And I think Archie would, I mean, he wants to be back in the rotation.
So put Archie in the rotation, and then you look back at the bullpen and say, you know, the reason we were able to get to this point and maybe be manager of the year was because of all these moving parts. Really interesting time. And then the Dodgers and Giants are talking about Giancarlo Stanton. Now, I would love to see Giancarlo Stanton. I call him Giancarlo. I'll just call him Gio. I would love to see him roll through Chase Field with the Giants or Dodgers all the time, all day long. I'm about what is the most entertaining, and that would be entertainment. I don't care. Some of you are like, what are you talking about? We don't want the Dodgers or Giants to become better. If you go get Stanton, is this your way of saying we're not going to keep Puig? But the Dodgers and Giants in on Stanton, that's really interesting. So the Hot Stove League is what's really good stuff. Last night I watched some of Duke and Michigan State and Grayson Allen. Grayson Allen last year was hated and was a baby and was a whiner and was suspended and then brought back. And last night he was great. And Duke, I don't see anybody touching Duke here. Their schedule the next few weeks, Duke's... Boy, they're good. So I watched some of that, and that led into the college football playoff show. Last night was the first time where I was watching the college football playoff and said, okay, this is not good for college football because it is the same four schools. There's like, I don't know, 5 or 6 schools every year that are going to end up in this thing. Maybe 10. But if you're Arizona or Arizona State, you're never, ever, ever, ever going to be in this unless you're perfect, because it's the same schools. How is it? Somebody explain to me, how is it Clemson was number 2 last night when, I don't know, Syracuse drilled Clemson? How's that happen in their number 2? How is it that Oklahoma's number 3 when, I don't know, they went to Ohio State and won? They beat Oklahoma State. They beat TCU. And Syracuse drilling Clemson keeps Clemson in front of them? How's that happen? You know, the Pac-12, they're hosed. This whole idea of, well, USC might be able to sneak in if they win out, there's not a chance. There'd have to be, Alabama would have to fall flat on their face. And everybody in front of, USC is 11 in the poll. So once again, the Pac-12 sitting there hoping maybe sort of kind of, no, it's not going to happen. And the SEC may again have two schools, and I don't think this is the best Alabama team. I mean, who's Alabama really beat? LSU and Mississippi State. So I'm going to get into that a little bit further on in the show. Jude LaCava is next. I'm Brad Sussmat. Welcome back. This segment of the show brought to you by Sagicor. Sagicor now, protect what matters most. You need life insurance. You need to take care of your family. Protect what matters most. Get over to SagicorNow.com and get that life insurance handled and get all the information you need. Sagicor Now, proud part of what we do here at Sports360AZ.com. Brad Sussmat with you. We partner with the Arizona Republic, AZ Central Sports, our television show on Fox Sports Arizona, Brad Sussmat Football AZ. 16 airings per week. We appreciate the partnership with them. Jude LaCava joins us now, Fox 10 Sports Director. Always good to catch up with Jude. Primarily on what is going on with the Suns, and for background's sake, Robert Sarver has been looking at wanting to get either a renovation or a new facility, depending on who you speak to. There has been movement on this that Jude has been all over the last few days. The basic understanding that I have on this is you've got a couple of council people, Gallego and Valenzuela, who are opposed to any sort of renovation. Jude can pick it up from there. How are you?
Hey, Brad. Yeah, I think that the instability or lack of stability in the political climate right now certainly doesn't help the effort for renovation, which would cost about $450 million. You've got Greg Stanton wanting to run for Congress. If he decides to resign in early January, there would be a runoff election in May, and both of those candidates you just mentioned want nothing to do with any kind of public assistance for a stadium renovation. So that certainly doesn't help. Now, as far as the news yesterday, my understanding was it was tense. The meetings went nowhere. They've been permanently suspended. Folks at the city of Phoenix basically were disappointed in the Suns' offer to contribute maybe about $75 million. That's just not enough. The bond proposal to get the job done would be around $225 million, and between the politicians not wanting to touch that with a 10-foot pole and not enough money being offered on the Suns side, this thing is suspended. And this is just the beginning of what I think is going to be a very long chapter of what this evolves to in terms of trying to get renovation and what Robert Sarver would like to accomplish with the arena.
So Jerry Colangelo told me on the show about a year ago that the footprint is too small. It's like Madison Square Garden is what he compared it to have a renovation, and that he thought it was looking elsewhere to build a new arena. Is that still the case? That may be considered old news now, but is that still the case, Jude, that the footprint just simply isn't big enough?
I've heard that before. I think that you'd have to really look at code in terms of going backwards towards Jackson Street. I think that there is space around the arena. Where there's a will, there's a way. But mm-hmm. the question is there a will? And mm-hmm. I don't see any politician, including Greg Stanton, carrying the banner for Robert Sarver as they did years ago for Jerry Colangelo, what was America West Arena. Right. So that's a big issue. The importance, the significance to downtown revitalization. And let's be honest here, and I've had people tweet, and I understand their passion for this. We don't even have enough dollars to go to respectable salaries for teachers. Right. So I get where the climate is today, and it's very real. If I'm a politician, I'm not hanging my hat on publicly assisted renovation or stadium issues. It's political suicide. So it's an issue for Robert Sarver. And you know, let's face it, there have been ballparks. Let's take San Francisco, the Giants, that have been privately funded. The money is there. The valuation for the franchise, Brad, is probably well over $1 billion right now.
Approaching $2 billion with the Houston sale. You know, that's the thing on this is we're talking about a banker. At the end of the day, and you and I both are on the same page as to where we believe Robert's, what he's done to the franchise on the court, which has run it into the ground. But as a businessman, he also has, in my opinion, Jude, I'm not going to speak on your part on this, but Seattle's sitting up there. They want a new team. Las Vegas is going to get an NBA team, and Kansas City's sitting there. Robert's got leverage all over the place on this deal, in my opinion.
He does. He does. And look, the NBA will expand to a couple of those cities that you mentioned. We can expect that. It also takes, you know, we got to go back to Robert's predecessor. Jerry was a very shrewd businessman, but he also understood the benefit for the city of Phoenix. This town didn't grow up until America West Arena was established, until Bank One Ballpark was built. And now we see a downtown that hosted a Super Bowl a few years back and did a fabulous job. I mean, I came from Toledo back in the late 80s. Toledo had more downtown action than the city of Phoenix. It grew up with these sports facilities, to be frank about it. So, but does Robert have the gravitas in the business community, in the political community, to get this thing done? I think that's really the question right now.
And I'd be curious what Adam Silver thinks of Robert Sarver in his ownership stable. Because he's taken a...
I know this. He's not impressed. I think he knows this has been a very successful franchise. And, you know, it's going to be 8 years now without a playoff sniff. So, I mean, let's face it. It's an issue. And certainly things go in cycles. But this has been a drought, a long, long drought. And no answer anytime soon.
I had some business people in town that suggested... And these are people that have been here a long time. And if you and I were sitting having a beer, we would talk openly about this. But I don't want to go that space. But they said the best thing that could happen is for Robert to move the team, leave the name behind, and that they would be able to fix all of this from top to bottom, including the arena and everything along those lines. I know that sounds extreme to some and not realistic to others. But these are people that could make it happen, in my opinion. Have you heard anything about
that?
Yeah,
that's not a bad model. Look, I've heard that discussion, Brad. Yeah, and, you know... there's very little confidence in what Mr. Sarver has done to this franchise over the last 7-8 years. So there is some logic to that. We've seen that with other franchises. So I think the real question is going to be, you know, what can be done? And yeah, but then again, that doesn't eliminate how this franchise is run, whether it's in Las Vegas or Seattle.
Oh, no, that's correct. That's correct. Talking with Jude LaCava, I know you got to get out of here in a couple minutes. The other scenarios that I've heard more recently is that the Diamondback spring training facility has not worked out exactly how people envisioned it to work out year round, and that could be a location for a new arena for the Suns. Have you heard anything like that?
Yes. Yeah, I would say this. I would say for the most part, that is correct. I think that the situation, and it could be very ironic, that when you turn and flip this thing, it could be the Coyotes ownership. If they can consolidate with a deep pockets owner along with Bearway to really look at a potential project on the reservation. Mm-hmm. That is still very real. I'll tell you that firsthand.
Yeah, and the other location is the 101-202, and I think that was the first priority, and that's the eye that Derek and Ken have had with the Diamondbacks. Because we've got to bring them into the discussion, too, that they're not out of the woods yet by any stretch of the imagination. Have you heard anything new on that front?
Nothing new there other than they feel confident they can win the lawsuit. That's the latest word. But they do want to look at winning that lawsuit and then creating some dollars and revenue streams that could maintain that facility.
All right. I would ask you about Hugh Jackson's future and if your Browns can ever figure anything out. But we only have a minute left, so I don't know if I can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I would not look at that with any sense of optimism, that's for sure.
More optimistic, Jude. Suns Arena, Browns figuring it out. There you go. There's one to split down the middle.
There you go.
Let you go off that. Issues. Thanks, man. See you soon.
You got it, Brad.
Take care. It's Jude LaCava checking in. Sports owners. It's most of them, as I have said through the years, are nuts. Most of them through the years make gobs and gobs of money, but they don't have really all that much together when it comes to community and what it means to own a sports franchise. I'm not calling them bad people. We all have blind spots. You have blind spots. I have blind spots. We all have blind spots. The blind spots of people that make gobs and gobs of dough is we can just do this with any model. We can just do this with any way possible and feasible because I've got money to throw at it. And as we've seen in the NBA or actually in sports in general, billionaires that run franchises into the ground. Money doesn't solve the problem. You're the problem. 8 years. It's going to be 8 years. You know, it's going to be 9 years, in my opinion. This whole nonsense about a timeline is just nonsense. It's nonsense. You have to look and not say, well, the owner's got to figure it out this time. No, he's had many, many times. And the building has been sitting there. We've been talking about what's going to happen with the building for a couple of years now. And now it's to the point where you've got people on the political front in Gallego and Valenzuela. They're not going to say, that's a great idea. Let's get involved in this. We got to keep our sons. No, it's not going to get them reelected. All right, on the other side, or elected to the next level. On the other side, I was in full rant mode on the college football playoff poll from last night. And I didn't even really scratch the surface. There's been some other college news today that I think is interesting that could involve one of the head football coaches here in Arizona. I'll get to that next on the college front. I'm Brad Sussmat. So there are some things in sports that, as you've watched the show through the years, I think you've gathered that there's things I don't like. There's just things that I look at and say, why are we doing this? August NFL football is one of those, because August NFL football has now led to like the first couple of weeks of the NFL regular season being nothing more than training camp games, guys getting hurt all over the place because they're not in shape because they just haven't played in August. And it's a joke. I see it. I think anybody that follows the NFL, all this swath of big injuries across the league, and we're not even halfway. This is the halfway mark of the season, and you know most of the workforce, a big name, is gone. That's not smart. One of the other ones I don't like is the joke that is SEC football when it comes to late November. Eric, did you see the big matchup, the Titanic tilt this weekend of Alabama and Auburn and who they're playing this weekend?
I did. I noticed that.
So Alabama's playing Mercer. Mm-hmm. Do we know Mercer's nickname? I don't know Mercer's nickname.
Ron Mercer, the former NBA player?
Ron Mercer was he was a Kentucky Wildcat, right?
Yep.
Does Edwin know it? Chairman of the board, Edwin? Did anybody know Mercer's nickname? I'll take Mercer for 100 off the board if anybody's got it. Alabama, the number one team in the country, is playing Mercer. Then you have Auburn playing Louisiana Monroe. They could play the state of Louisiana, and they could play the city of Monroe, and they'll still beat them by 80. And these are two teams. My rant on this is the college football playoff show that Eric hates, that I'm just kind of amused by. Last night, when they're running through Alabama at number one, and Alabama's playing Mercer, and they're going to go through strength of schedule. They talk about strength of schedule. If strength of schedule truly were a big factor, Alabama would be nowhere next week. Alabama's biggest wins are against Mississippi State, and that's because Mississippi State crapped down their leg in the last minute. And LSU. Auburn, they gagged against LSU. They choked like a dog against LSU. And Louisiana Monroe and Auburn's being talked about. So, you know, I get mad, I get grumpy when Arizona State plays these weak schools in the early part of the season and U of A does the same thing. There's no cutting it. They play these tune-up games. But I think it's really insulting that the week before, when we're sitting here in November, the biggest games of the year, they do these glorified scrimmages and they're not penalized for it. It's gutless on the committee's part to not sit there and say, we are going to drop you. Like, if they really want to send a statement, Alabama was not going to drop out of the top, you know, the top four. But if they really want to send a statement, next week they're down to number four. Why do we drop? You played freaking Mercer. We are not going to reward you for playing Mercer anymore. Those days are gone. And when you're a school like Arizona State or Arizona, how is it you are ever going to be part of this format the way that it exists presently? Because at the start of the year, the polls are going to have the same 8 to 10 schools. Every year, it's going to be the same schools. The ACC is sitting there today, thrilled to death that they could possibly have two schools in the Final Four. And one of those two schools got boat raced by Syracuse. The other one had to escape against North Carolina. The last time I checked was a one-win team. I'm guessing this week that when Miami plays Virginia, they're probably not going to have the same sort of intensity. If I'm a betting man, whatever the line is, I'm going to bet that Virginia covers. It's just the way it is. But seriously, if we're sitting out here on the West Coast and Washington, Stanford, USC were the best hopes. And what happened to USC? They got crushed by Notre Dame. They got destroyed by Notre Dame.
However,
yeah.
Where did they come in last night?
11.
11, okay. It's unlikely that they could make the top four. It's unlikely.
However, yeah.
It's not impossible.
They beat UCLA. They beat Cal. They win the Pac-12 title game.
It's more of what happens above them.
But what happens, they've got to take care of their business.
Because last week we saw, three teams in the top eight lose? Of course, Alabama's not going to lose to Mercer. And Alabama is really the only team in college football that doesn't have a wart. All the other teams have at least one wart.
But they are not impressive. This is not a grinding Alabama team.
But it is what it is.
It's a brand.
But they're undefeated.
It's a brand.
If you play all your games and you don't lose any of them, you deserve at least the opportunity to play in the playoff. And that pains me to say because Wisconsin has really beaten no one.
No one.
But if you come from a Power 5 conference and you run the table, and that includes winning your conference championship game, it's going to be hard for the committee to leave a team like that out.
Okay, so if you're Ohio State, Ohio State came in at 9.
Yep.
They still haven't played Michigan.
Who conveniently somehow snuck back into the top 25.
Somehow they
did. Love how that works.
No, and so Ohio State is still alive, even though Iowa crushed them. And crushed them here just in the last few weeks. Remember the whole narrative about it's not how you lose, it's when you lose?
Right.
Throw that out the window. Should Clemson
well,
be...
Well, I mean, not really, because look at Clemson. They lost towards the beginning of the year, and right, if the playoffs started tomorrow, they would be one of the four teams in.
But Iowa crushes Ohio State just a couple of weeks ago, and Ohio State is still sitting there. Like, are they really being penalized? I think if you peel the banana on each one of these teams, peel the onion, the banana, whatever it is, okay? Whatever it is, you go through each one of these schools and you say, okay, what is the thinking that Auburn beats Georgia by 23, yet Georgia is still part of the conversation? What is the thinking on that at this point of the year?
Because they only have one loss and they beat Notre Dame.
And again, the brand name Notre Dame.
There's no doubt. There's no doubt brand names help.
Okay,
there's
USC,
no question.
USC has not had a bye week all year. Should that factor in on this? When you're weighing how a team looks, every week they've had to compete. It doesn't factor?
I don't think so. It's a bad break.
I disagree.
It's a bad break, but it's nothing, I don't know how you can penalize a team above or below them because USC didn't have a bye week. That's not their problem.
What is this week for Alabama and Auburn? Bye weeks.
Essentially, they are bye
weeks. In late November, and they probably had some byes earlier in the year.
But this is nothing, Brad, that hasn't been happening in the SEC for decades.
But
these games are very common in November.
And you're right about that, but this is why, under this format, there's things like Mercer and Louisiana Monroe the week before your biggest game of the year where you're just taking it off that have to change. If you're going to rank them and talk about strength of schedule, then penalize them this coming week and drop them down 3 or 4 and stand there and take the heat.
I feel like although Alabama might not be as dominant as they have been in the past, they have a way of just flipping the switch when it comes to a big game. And that team I'm the least concerned of all the teams up there in top four. Because Alabama just has the pedigree. They've been there before. They know how to win. They've won national championship. Last year they got to the championship. And I wouldn't want to play them.
So Charles made a bet with Jalen Hurts last night on the air.
Mm.
Pretty simple. Charles on TNT last night said, I'm either going to wear an Alabama jersey on TV or he's going to have to wear an Auburn jersey on campus. Made that bet. My Tigers need to win because I don't want to wear that crap on TNT, was his quote. That's pretty funny. Have you noticed in the SEC, by the way, one other thing? The SEC is really the model for all other college football conferences to some degree. Would we agree on that, you and I?
Sure.
Okay.
I don't think it's the best conference this year, but yeah. I would agree with you, yes.
They have the most revenue coming
in. Yes, they do. They have their own network that people can actually see.
That people can see. So This morning, Jeff Long got fired at Arkansas.
Darn.
Brett Bielema is going to get fired at Arkansas.
Most likely.
That's going to happen. Florida's already open. Tennessee's open. Ole Miss is open. Every year, it feels to me like there's five or six coaches in the SEC that are fired and that they've just, we've gave them 2 years, it didn't work out, your history. Okay, so should the Pac-12 start having that same sort of if you can't get it done here on short order, you're going to be done. You're going to be fired, and you're going to be blown out at halftime. John Gruden admitted this morning, he was on Mike and Mike. Mike and Mike is ending. This is their last week ever after 17 years. He admitted this morning that he is intrigued and is not going to rule out the Tennessee job. Last time John Gruden coached on a college side or pro side, does it work out? I heard somebody talking about Lovie Smith and how it's not gone well for him at Illinois. He's going to get fired. He's had 2 years. They've won maybe five or six games. You think that you hire a big name. Is Chip Kelly going to come in and resurrect something? Is John Gruden going to come in and do nothing more than Big Booster is going to be enamored that John Gruden shows up and speaks? Like the Tennessee job, you would think Tennessee, Florida, in particular Tennessee, would have it figured out. And they've gone through like three coaches. They always get their doors blown off. It's amazing to me. Michael Fabiano is next. All things around the fantasy football front. I'm Brad Sussmat. And now let's go to Los Angeles. It is time to get your fantasy football team straightened out. In my case, definitely straightened out. I have Cam Newton this week and Ty Montgomery got hurt, so I am just hosed. So I've been looking forward to talking to Michael Fabiano. I'm not going to bore all of you with my stuff because Michael's going to cover a lot of ground. And Nathan Peterman is going to be at the top of the board today because I'm getting a lot of questions here just in the last half hour. The Bills say enough of Tyrod Taylor, so let's get to the Hall of Famer and see what Michael Fabiano at the NFL Network thinks about Buffalo and other stuff. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'd be a lot better if I had a Cam Newton solution. I don't. I'm looking at Blake Bortles or Ryan Fitzpatrick this week, as a lot of people in the mailbag are looking at not having Cam. So that's how I am.
Yeah, well, it's become a difficult position, the quarterback spot, all of a sudden due to the injuries. And as you mentioned, Tyrod's being benched for some reason, which I don't understand. I'm guessing it's because McDermott wants to have his guy in there. You've got Blaine Gabbert starting for the Cardinals now.
Yep,
so
yep.
The quarterback position has suddenly become a little bit thin, especially with four teams on a bye, including Cam Newton.
Okay, so what would your strategy be on the waiver wire? Because I'm getting overrun with, I've got Cam, here are my options in said league, and a lot of them are Fitzpatrick and Bortles to start with.
Mm-hmm. And those are two, I mean, they're not 1A options, let's
sure.
put it that way.
Sure.
But you can do worse. I don't know if that gives anyone any confidence out there. I think Case Keenum is clearly an option this week. I think Jay Cutler is an option because of the matchup. Eli Manning is also a pretty good option based on the matchup against Kansas City and the potential game script there. So those are a few quarterbacks that I would be looking to add ahead of a Brett Hundley or a Blaine Gabbert, for example. But those are solutions that might not be available in leagues with 12 or more teams. So Fitzpatrick is also an option there too. But again, that Buccaneers offense,
yeah.
Boy, it was bad last week, but they also didn't have Mike Evans. So we'll see if they can potentially bounce back. I'll tell you one thing. I'm not starting Nathan Peterman. I will promise you that.
Well, now I was looking at Charles Clay as an ad this week, and, you know, I'm hosed on that. There's not a chance I'm going to touch anybody with Buffalo. I've got LeSean McCoy, which is probably a benefit to me. You know, as much yep. as I didn't want to talk about my team, but it's all being impacted by this stuff.
Yeah, it is. And Clay is someone to pick up. He was one of the five best tight ends in PPR leagues before he went down earlier this season. But now you're looking at rookie quarterback plus tough matchup against the Chargers, who have been very strict and difficult to score on when it comes to the tight end position.
Mm-hmm.
So Clay is someone that I would err on the side of caution and sit if you need a tight end this week. Tyler Croft is an option. Vernon Davis is still floating out there on the waiver wire in some leagues, which I don't get. And as long as Jordan Reed is out, Vernon Davis is a very solid start. And then you've got some lesser options out there, for example, like an Austin Hooper, who's coming off a decent game. Ben Watson is also an option. But that position, too, much like the quarterback spot, is dangerously thin. I will tell you this. If you're in a league where Greg Olsen got dropped, pick him up now, stash him, because he expected to be back in week 12.
All right, and that's good stuff on picking up and stashing someone, because, Michael, we're in that time of year where, and I'll get back to the mailbag in a second, but we're in that time of year where a lot of guys are saying, my team stinks, it's over for 2017. Do you just dump your roster, or do you start planning ahead in some of these leagues for 18 and be strategic? Don't not pay attention to your team.
No, that's the worst thing you can do. I mean, I have a league where I have the fourth most points, and I have 3 wins. And, I mean, it's just bad luck. I mean, it's 12 teams, and I have the fourth most points. But I play spoiler. I don't give up. I'm probably not going to make the playoffs in that league, but I'm not going to give up, because if I play a team that actually is in contention and I roll over and die, well, I'm hurting another team in the league who might be in contention for the playoffs. And you're not looking ahead to 2018 unless you're looking at a dynasty league or a potential keeper league. But in seasonal redraft leagues, I keep playing this out. And I keep making trades. I keep adding people off the waiver wire until the playoffs come, and then I'm no longer in contention. And then at that point, I'm done. But anybody who drops good players because their team is out of it, or rolls over and does nothing because their team is out of it, those are owners that I would remove from my league the following year.
Okay, dynasty league strategy then, same situation. Are there guys out there that you're looking at saying, your team may have had bad luck this year, or this guy has not been able to be on the field for whatever reason, go get him, go stash him?
Well, no, I mean, in dynasty leagues, you're not going to have much out there on the waiver wire.
Right.
The strategy there is to look at the teams that are in contention that might need a piece that you have. It's almost like if you think about baseball, where 2 years ago, and I'll use the Yankees as an example because I'm a Yankees fan, when the Yanks traded Aroldis Chapman and they traded Andrew Miller and they brought in all these young pieces, and all of a sudden now they've got the best farm system in baseball, and they're a team that could be ready to build a dynasty here. Well, that's what you want to do in your dynasty league.
Right.
You can go ahead and trade away a very good player who might be a little older, say, for example, a Larry Fitzgerald, who is still unbelievably productive, but who knows in terms of how much longer he's going to be in the NFL. This could be his last season. You don't know. So go out and grab a younger player, because you can go out and look at a team that is in contention and could make a run at a championship and could need a guy like Larry Fitzgerald, and you can get something back, some younger pieces to your team. And this way, you're looking ahead to next season, trying to build on a little bit of youth, and you're trading away a piece that you may not even be able to use moving forward.
Get a lot of questions from Michael Fabiano, the Hall of Famer, with us from the NFL Network every week talking fantasy football, about things other than just players. But the overriding one, and this has been building the last few weeks, and is this, Michael, because the injuries in the NFL have added up year after year, but this year in particular, it's only getting greater with more and more players going down. Are you a fan of having two waiver picks per week if you want within a league?
Well, in all the leagues that I play in, you have unlimited waiver claims. So you can make as many add drops as you want. And once that first wave runs, then it's basically first come, first serve for any player who had not been dropped within the last 24 hours. And so I don't see there being any benefit to having a restriction to waiver claims, just like I don't feel like there's any benefit to having a restriction in terms of how many trades you can make a year, because at the end of the day, fantasy football is supposed to be fun.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing that I say to people who believe that it's too easy to allow reserve spots on your roster. I think that's a good thing. The NFL has adjusted, and they now have IR spots for players who can return during the course of the season instead of having to put a guy on IR and he's done. So if you have these reserve spots, if you lost a Greg Olsen, if you lost a Danny Woodhead, for example, you can keep them on your roster and not eat up a bench spot. Instead, much like the NFL does, you can sit back and wait and sort of see what happens with the player, because it would really stink if you, for example, had David Johnson and say we're not in the scenario that we're in and David was going to come back in a week or two.
Right.
Instead of having to eat up a bench spot for 13 weeks, you could put him on your reserve spot, and when he comes back, he's on your roster. And that's only fair because you drafted the guy or you picked the guy up a waiver, whatever the case may be. So those are a couple of things that I like to do in my leagues. I don't restrict waiver claims. I don't restrict trades. You can do as many as you want, and I like to have that reserve spot. And I think after this year, with all the injuries to all the studs, you're going to see fantasy owners start utilizing that position a little bit more. And that reserve space is, at least on NFL.com, restricted to players who are suspended. So, for example, Ezekiel Elliott, or players who are on injured reserve, designated to come back, for example, Greg Olsen or Danny Woodhead.
Yeah, I mean, Ezekiel Elliott's been great for me, and I'm sure I would think you would have him on some of your teams.
Three leagues.
Yeah, but it's absolutely been gut-wrenching every week of, okay, is this guy going to play or not play? Now that he's not playing, how long is he not going to play for? Mm-hmm. And the legal system, it changes every day. And I'm getting a lot of questions from fans about Ezekiel Elliott. In fact, that's the most commonly asked question. And I'm not going to go there. Instead, I'm going to switch over to Danny Woodhead because you brought him up. And I'm going to bring up Jamal Williams, too, because I'm sitting here with Ty Montgomery. Where are you at with Danny Woodhead and Jamal Williams?
Well, Woodhead needs to be added in PPR leagues without question, and I just think the roadblock with him has been injuries. And when he's on the field, he's terrific, but he's been prone to injuries over the last few seasons. Jamal Williams looks like he could be the man this week in Green Bay. Ty Montgomery's banged up. We know Aaron Jones is out for several weeks. Williams is a volume play, especially if Montgomery is inactive.
Yeah.
But his yards per carry average is not good. So there are situations, like, for example, Adrian Peterson this week, bad matchup, but you're probably going to play him because of the volume situation.
Yep.
Sometimes volume is more important than matchup, and we've seen that with tight ends like Vernon Davis, for example. Like Jason Witten last week, for example, matchup was bad, but because Zeke was out, they threw the ball more, and Witten had a pretty good PPR afternoon. So those are situations where, okay, Williams has a mediocre matchup this week, but I'm still going to play him because there's going to be volume. Samaje Perine is another example. Not a great matchup this week, but you can potentially flex him in a standard scoring league because Rob Kelly is injured and no longer an option for the Skins or for fantasy owners, so Perine can see some touches too, and we're seeing a lot of that. That's something that fantasy owners have to remember. The matchup could be bad, but depending on what the depth is on your team at that position, if a player is going to get volume and you know he's going to get volume, then sometimes it's worth rolling the dice and putting him out there hoping that, well, maybe he finds the end zone because he's going to see, for example, 20 touches in a game like an Adrian Peterson.
Right. Last question before I let you go. I appreciate your time as always. Biggest questions you've been getting asked this week, looking at this weekend's games about matchups?
Well, number one, is there a Cowboys running back to start? And this week, if you have to start one, it's Morris. Do you start Jared Goff this week? Jared Goff has been the hottest quarterback in the league, or at least one of the two or three hottest quarterbacks in the league in the last 2 weeks. 7 touchdowns in his last 2 games, but he's got Minnesota this week. And he put up those 7 touchdowns against the Giants, who are terrible, and the Texans, who are not that good against the pass either. So this is a big week for Jared Goff. Would I start him? I mean, it depends on what else you have and what your alternatives are, but this is sort of the litmus test for, I can start Jared Goff week in and week out with confidence, or Jared Goff is a matchup-based starter, and I can't play him when he's going up against a tough defense on the road. Another question is Robert Woods. I mean, this guy's been Antonio Brown for the last couple of weeks, but
great.
Same situation. Can he do it against the Vikings on the road? And I think Xavier Rhodes is probably going to be on Sammy Watkins in this contest, so I still like Woods in the game, but these are questions that you have to have answered, because you're not going to be able to have a lot of confidence in a guy like Jared Goff as your starter week in and week out if he has proven that he can't get it done on the road against really good defenses. And again, this is a very big litmus test for this team. And I've also gotten a lot of questions about the Patriots' backfield.
Yeah.
I think legitimately you can start all three. You can start Burkhead, you can start White, you can start Deion Lewis this week because the matchup is good and they're utilizing all three of these guys in a prominent fashion in New England, especially if Chris Hogan is out again. I mean, that's going to just be more targets and more opportunities for those guys, and they can all catch the ball out of the backfield.
Stay well. Have a great week. Thanks.
All right, pal. You too.
Michael Fabiano right there in Los Angeles at the NFL Network from their studios. All things around the fantasy football fix to get you ready for the upcoming weekend. Sports360AZ.com. We partner with the Arizona Republic, AZ Central Sports. I'm Brad Sismat. Time now for Talk to the Lopes. Every week we talk Grand Canyon University athletics year-round. Things going on at GCU. And this week we're going to focus in on the Antelope Gymnasium and the men's volleyball program that gets started in early January. Matt Worley is with us, the head coach, as they get ready for the 2018 season. They had a terrific run last year, getting the program turned around, 11 wins, the most in team history to start out. They finished 18-11 on the year. Started out perfect to get the season going at 5-0. And you look at their schedule, you look at the growth of the program. And me being 6'8", they always said, go play front row, but I couldn't jump, so I was not a great outside hitter. That's why I just talk about it professionally. Matt, how are you?
I'm doing well, Brad. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, no worries. No worries. Tell me about growth of the program. You came over to GCU a couple of years back, year and a half back, actually, about now, and the growth and where you see the program at now.
Yeah, so actually my history goes even a little bit further back. I moved to Phoenix from Southern California about 6.5 years ago. They brought me on as the graduate assistant. I fell in love with the university, really just kind of wanted to stay on as long as possible. And I actually took a head coaching position at the age of 26 over at Mesa Community College on the women's side of the sport. And after, you know, being on the women's side of the sport for a couple of years, I took an opportunity to come back to the men's side. And it's just, I mean, the way the university supports all of the athletics, I mean, it's just one of a kind. So the opportunity to come back and, you know, be the head coach here at Grand Canyon was just something special that I couldn't turn down. And, you know, like I said, the program's growth has been pretty much weighing on the success of the university as a whole.
When you got started into coaching, you coached at the club level too, right?
Yeah, so after I graduated from college, I moved to Southern California. I trained with the USA men's national team for a year, got into coaching some club sports out there. I think the club at the time was the Orange County Riptides, which was a huge boys club that goes back, you know, many, many years. But also my parents were coaches. They actually met coaching against each other, so I was born and raised in a gym.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And when you're coaching club, you did the Arizona club coaching circuit too when you came over?
Yeah, so Arizona Fear is a club that I've been a part of since I've moved here. And Troy Dooling, who runs Arizona Fear, has done a great job of just growing the sport in the state of Arizona, because boys volleyball is a little bit underrated. It is growing. It is becoming stronger. There's better athletes that are getting involved. But it's still just one of those sports that kind of pops up in the Olympics. Everybody falls in love with men's volleyball, and then it kind of disappears. And unless you're regionally located in Chicago or Southern California, you don't hear a lot about it.
Yeah, yeah. No, my son played on the club circuit here, and then he moved on from it. Now I've got a 13-year-old who's 6'5", and he's just came to me the other day and said, I want to try volleyball for the first time, and he's only a seventh grader.
And I like to hear that.
He's got big size, Coach. That's all I'm saying. I'm not throwing recruiting stuff at you, but it is harder, me growing up in Southern California in Carlsbad, where volleyball is on every corner and everybody's playing it and everybody gets it. We've been out here 20-plus years, and it's taken time for the men's side to grow. I feel like the women's side, it has a lot of structure. The men's side is still trying to find their facing and pacing, I guess is the right way to put it.
Sure. It's definitely an underrated sport in the state of Arizona. One of my initiatives is actually to try to get the growth of the game in the state of Arizona just – a little bit more rapid. You know, Ottawa University, that just opened up a satellite location in Surprise, you know, they're opening an NAIA men's program that's actually starting this year. You know, Benedictine and Mesa now has a program, but, you know, Arizona Club or Arizona State University, their club team's pretty good. You know, University of Arizona's club team is very good. I know NAU has a program. GCU also has a club team. I mean, there are some opportunities in the state. They're just not promoted all that well.
When I notice on your schedule, you've scheduled Ottawa. I mean, I think that's really cool that you're saying, okay, let's grow this. And we can grow it through our program. A, B, I think this speaks to the athletic director and the president saying, we're okay with you playing these local schools. It makes sense financially. It makes sense to grow the sport.
Yeah. You know, like I said, the growth in Arizona needs to happen. It's just until these kids go to a match and, you know, get exposed to right. the sport and the elite level of athlete that's, you know, involved in the sport, they're just, I guess, more unaware and uneducated on how much fun the game of volleyball is.
Matt Worley is with us. He is the GCU men's volleyball head coach. They start their season in early January. So take me through what you're doing this time of year as you get ready for the start of the season, like a training day for your guys, or how often you can get them in the gym and work.
Sure. So the NCAA obviously really prohibits the amount of time that we could spend right. with them. So we right. just wrapped up our fall, you know, non-traditional season here on Saturday. We had a scrimmage out in LA at USC, and there was, I think, 8 teams there, just kind of, you know, playing a little round robin tournament scrimmage style. But we had about 5.5 weeks, 2 hours a day with the guys in the practice gym, and that's what we just finished up. So we're relatively hands off until December 27th when the guys come back from Christmas and we get going in our preseason.
And you look at your team this year, what do you like? What do you have questions about?
So, you know, one of the things coming in this year, we have 9 seniors, and 9 seniors on a 22-man roster is a lot. You know, I thought that was going to be something that would be very, very easy to handle. Mm-hmm. But these guys with the experience, there's been an interesting distribution of power among the 9 guys. You know, 4 of them all play in the same position, and they're all guys that would be deserving to be on the court and, you know, be starters. But I think it's going to be one of those things that, you know, makes our practice gym really competitive, but also the depth that we're going to have on the bench. We should be able to, you know, last a season and be in good health. So there, it's kind of a double-edged sword there. When we have the leadership, we have the experience, but still we're kind of waiting for that certain individual to really step out and just kind of be the man.
Okay, there's been a lot, Matt, talked about with the basketball program and sports being allowed to go through Division I now because of the probationary period being out of the way and everybody's eligible to go after it. How does this impact what you're doing on men's volleyball at GCU?
So it actually had no impact on us. Division I and Division II in men's volleyball are actually one and considered one division. So we're all playing for that national championship together. There's only 42 programs out there combined, Division I and II. So we've been postseason eligible throughout the whole, you know, probationary transition period.
And so for you, it's great for basketball. You can get some kids on campus for volleyball and a recruiting visit and walk them into the gym and show them the enthusiasm, I'm sure.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, the obviously the Havocs and what they do in the basketball arena is just like none other across the country. So it's just, GCU is special in a sense that each sport really, you know, contributes and supports to the other sports. So we actually have a very, very strong relationship and a program that we're working right now with our softball team, where we are actually working together to do, you know, charitable events.
That's cool.
You know, around the Phoenix area. And it's just such a community base here, which is great.
And the Havocs, they show up for volleyball?
They do. It's obviously not in such a full force as they do for basketball, but our crowd, and I prefer to play in Antelope Gym just because 800 to 900 fans in Antelope Gym with a band, with a DJ and cheerleaders, and then you throw some Havocs into the mix, it's a really, really tough place for opponents to play.
That's good. From a scheduling standpoint, you know, I look at your schedule and you've got the Pepperdines and the UCLA and Hawaii and USC. Putting that schedule together, because of your connections, it would seem to me, in Southern California, that would not be that difficult. Or is it that difficult to get schools to want to play you?
So the Pepperdine, UCLA, BYU, Stanford, USC, those schools right now are actually in our conference. So we've made this transition from the MIVA, which included all the Midwest schools, Loyola Chicago, Ohio State. This is going to be our first year entering the MPSF with these historical programs that, you know, hold 70% of the national championships ever played.
Right.
It is tough to get some schools to come to Phoenix just because, you know, with how RPI and strength of schedule really weighs in, a lot of teams don't want to come to Phoenix and play us twice. They want a little bit more variety on their schedule.
Got it.
So even the fact that we're playing Hawaii in Tennessee. We're playing Hawaii in Nashville at a tournament. So we're trying to schedule quite a variety amongst the different conferences, but also, you know, throw some teams into the mix. Like our first match, we open up at Barton in North Carolina. They were in the tournament last year. You know, they're a Conference Carolina school. You know, they entered the tournament and have some experience at, you know, the moment, I guess you could say. But it's fun. It's fun to piece together a schedule to try to put yourself in a really good position to kind of boost some confidence, get some wins here and there. But also, you got to challenge the guys so they're ready come April.
Okay, let's talk recruiting then. When you go into someone's home, what is your pitch? And maybe even take me back a little bit further. Do you identify purely through club matches or do you go other routes? How do you go find them? And then what is your pitch?
You know, I try to, you know, being so new into this, there's some coaches that are Hall of Famers out there. You know, they have the reputation. I'm just entering my third year and I don't really have the background with relationships with these club directors and coaches across the country. I have a lot more connections, I think, with the college coaches than I do the club coaches. So I'm trying to get into these club practice gyms and create things on a little bit more of a personal level as opposed to, you know, showing up to a tournament in Southern California, because you can really see, you know, every kid in the country in July at one tournament if you're there for 8 days. I mean, that's how kind of small men's volleyball really is. But every day that I'm out there recruiting, you can sure bet that I'm in a purple polo shirt or a purple jacket trying to stand out as best as possible.
And to localize it, where do you find players here in Arizona? How do you go about it?
So we actually, this past year, we recruited a guy. He's a freshman now. He's a 6'7 outside. He went to Horizon Honors. Really good guy. He played for Aspire Volleyball Club. He's working hard. He's actually turning into a leader in the gym just because of his own work ethic. And we also have another guy coming in from Campo Verde out of the 2018 class. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're really, you know, we find these guys at club tournament. It's tough to promote that because sometimes it can be such a financial burden on families to be a part of club sports.
Yep.
But it's important for them to realize high school, the talent is a little bit more diluted. So it's tough to kind of get into a high school match, but also high school in Arizona takes place during the same time frame as our season. So it's really tough to recruit, you know, in season for us.
Good stuff. Like to get the base built around you. Look forward to having you back on again down the road, Matt. Best of luck.
Appreciate that, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Matt Worley there, the head volleyball coach at GCU. Their regular season gets started on January 4th against Barton on the road. Their first home match at GCU at Antelope Gymnasium will be January 18th. That's on a Thursday night. Thanks for checking out this podcast on sports360az.com, brought to you by your Valley Hyundai dealers.